ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
How reliable is your memory of a crime scene? And can those memories be manipulated?
Connected to wrongful convictions?
How a memory works can be damaging for a justice system and for the integrity of a justice system.
This is Sana Qadar from All in the Mind. If you are a fan of true crime, you should check out our new series, Forensic. It's about the quirks and curiosities of our weird human brains. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This week on The Science Show, we're examining the joys of pollination.
While celebrating two influential botanists, one on the West Coast and one on the East.
We'll learn how to swab a sleeping seal's nose.
Can't wait. And meet the new president of the Australian Academy of Science. I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith. The big ticket item this week was the federal budget, and there was some news in there for science and research. The general reaction has been that the budget laid out some good first steps towards supporting Australian research and science, but there's still a long way to go. So let's have a look at the main points. First up, the Ambitious Australia report, which we have covered quite a lot on The Science Show, it set out a bunch of recommendations to support R&D in Australia. The government will start implementing some of those recommendations, including establishing a National Resilience and Science Council. And this is something that people in the sector have been asking for years. In terms of money, various organisations will get a funding boost, such as the CSIRO. We found this out before the budget was announced. It'll get nearly $390 million over the next 4 years. But the big one, and this is the one I was looking out for, was if there was going to be any movement on lifting the funding cap of the Medical Research Future Fund. Now, that's a pot of money that was supposed to disperse $1 billion a year to medical research, but it was capped in 2022 to $650 million a year. This current budget raises those annual disbursements to the full billion, but from the 2030-31 financial year. And I've spoken to researchers who would really like to know why that full billion isn't being paid from this coming financial year. In the meantime, though, the government will distribute an extra $500 million or so over the next 4 years to research, which does sound good until you realise that the government also suddenly canned a program last week called the Economic Accelerator Program, which gave grants to support commercialisation of university research. And that saved the government $800 million over the next 5 years. So that's just a really quick look at science in the federal budget. A lot of money being shuffled around, and we'll have a closer look at what all this means in the coming weeks.
Thanks, Belle. Well, there are two great uncertainties as we grow up. First, the meaning of life, and second, the fate of the universe. The universe seemed sorted, especially when Professor Brian Schmidt in Canberra got his Nobel Prize, but since there have been doubts. As I watch the reporting of science, we're popular press to some extent, but New Scientist is a fairly serious science magazine and it is very attractive, but it is also pretty damn reliable. And for the last 2, 3, 4 years, it's been saying again and again, our understanding of cosmology, even perhaps, who knows, dark energy and the expansion of the universe could be open to question. Is that exaggeration or do you think there's a case to be made?
Oh, we're definitely, I think, in a situation where we really don't know what's going on. I was, to be honest, surprised when I won the Nobel Prize in 2011 for dark energy because I knew we did not understand what dark energy was. We had this very simple model that fit all the data and continues to fit it pretty well. But cracks are emerging, and those cracks involve observations where we compare how fast the universe is expanding now, the Hubble constant, with how fast the universe is expanding by looking at the cosmic microwave background, which is the afterglow of the Big Bang. So it turns out that afterglow of the Big Bang gives us an amazing experiment that allows us to very precisely measure what the universe was like 300,000 years after the Big Bang, 13 and a bit billion years ago. And if you project forward, the measurement of the expansion rate of the universe is different by about 8% from what we measure locally. Now, theorists, people with pens and papers who don't really look at the sky but try to understand it, usually the smartest people in our field, have been given 5 years the opportunity to figure out a reasonable explanation for this, have been unable to do so. It's still no reasonable way to make these things come together. And so their gut feeling is, well, then the observations just must be wrong. But I believe the observations are becoming good enough that there's a genuine crisis. And 8% doesn't sound like much, but in physics, which is known as an exact science, if you're off in one part in 10 to the 9, you're liable to win a Nobel Prize for that discovery. So being off by 8% is pretty bad. And I think it's something we really need to look at. And indeed, one of my principal areas of work right now is to try to make a completely independent way of measuring the nearby distance scale to double check it so that we can really see if this kind of crazy discrepancy is there. And if that discrepancy is present, it's really hard to know exactly what it means. And I don't know at this point.
Well, of course, if you're dealing with the entire universe, vastness beyond belief, and there where you've got black holes and you've got various physical things that bewildered even Einstein, well, you'd expect there to be a bit of puzzle. But what would you actually do practically to do these sort of measurements and the checking? Very, very bright stars, exploding stars, various things in the far distance, getting the measurements checked again, is that the sort of thing?
Yeah, there's all sorts of clever tricks that astronomers use to measure distance. So most of them are relative distances. This object looks half the size as this object, therefore it's twice as far. This object is four times fainter than this object, it's twice as far. There are a few ways of using exploding stars where you just use physics and you say, how many watts is this thing emitting? How many watts are coming to Earth? How do I go through and then figure out one over r squared distance law and measure its distance just as a ruler? It's a direct ruler. It's not a relative distance. We have ways we would hope to use gravitational wave mergers of neutron stars to do this. We found one. In 2017, we haven't found another one. So we thought if we got about 20 of those, we could do it really well that way. And we still could, but we've got to find 20 of these things. And I reckon that's about a decade away because they seem much rarer than we had expected. So coming up with other ways of measuring distances that are completely independent of everything else is really hard. There's another one using gravitational magnification by lenses. That's another one, and that seems to get the same answer, but it's got a lot of really messy astrophysics in it. You make those measurements. The cosmic microwave background, there's only one experiment. It's really, really good, but you only get one shot at it.
The echo from the Big Bang.
The echo from the Big Bang. There's one go at it, and if you divide that experiment into two halves, the way you look at it is the size of sound waves of different scales and how many you have of the different scales. So how many big sound waves are there? How many little sound waves are there? Because yes, the universe is full of sound. It's just very low tone, like the length of the sound wave. And if you divide it in half, it turns out you actually get two different values for the Hubble constant, the expansion rate, that aren't quite as discrepant as what we're seeing, but they're discrepant enough to be worrying. But no one has figured out how to really check that work yet. So I think we need to keep on doing these measurements and then have really smart people, probably some young people who are unindoctrinated in what's right, come in and hopefully come up with a solution.
I would have thought that, what you just said is good news, because if you're looking around Australia and you have some bright people, young men and women, here is a challenge. Do the science. Join the firm, get on with it. Are you going to take part yourself in doing practical research?
Absolutely. So as I said, I have a student who started working specifically to measure that nearby distance. I'm just not smart enough to do the theory. And so we need some really clever, creative people, the Einstein of our generation, to see if they can come up with a way to reconcile all this stuff. But yeah, there's no shortage of problems, because I've just told you about cosmology on the global sense. The universe is full of black holes. We don't understand why they're so big and so many of them. We still haven't figured out why neutrinos have mass. We don't understand why we exist here at all. You know, the standard particle physics said we should all have been gamma rays after the Big Bang, and there should be no matter at all. So yeah. There are lots of big questions. And what's dark matter? We've talked about dark energy.
We don't axions.
Well, there are axions. There's fuzzy dark matter. But there's a bunch of stuff we've tried to measure, and we keep on getting nothing. Axions are particularly difficult to measure, it turns out.
Yeah. And it was Frank Wilczek who named axions after, it was in the kitchen, there was some detergent. And that's a nice name.
Indeed. We have all sorts of things. We have axions, we have wimps, we have machos. Probably not very PC terms anymore, but we weren't very PC back 30 years ago. We're a bit better now, but I would still say we're a bit irreverent.
Well, thank you very much, and good luck with your second Nobel Prize in the offing, perhaps.
I never thought I'd win the first one. I'm definitely not going to win a second one. It'll go to a younger, smarter, more capable person than me.
Professor Brian Schmidt of the Australian National University, and he's too modest. But now an announcement that could make a difference. The Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument at Kitt Peak National Observatory in Arizona has just finished mapping more than 5 million extra distant galaxies, multiplying knowledge by almost 10 times. It'll take a little while to analyse it all, but at last it could soon once more be clear, and who knows, Brian's Nobel should be safe. Watch this infinite space, Bell.
Well, from the cold reaches of space to the frozen continent, Antarctica, and the disease leaving a trail of death in its wake, H5N1 avian influenza. Tracking the virus's spread from flying seabirds to penguins and even seals is Dr. Megan Dewar from Federation University. She's not long back from an expedition down south where, armed with nasal swabs and an inflatable Zodiac dinghy, she collected samples from wildlife. And this is what she found.
So we've definitely found avian influenza, unfortunately. So in March 2024, we got to go to lots of places within the Weddell Sea, and unfortunately we did find some mass mortality events which were due to bird flu. And then in our subsequent seasons, we found avian influenza down the peninsula as well.
What kinds of animals do you monitor or surveil for bird flu?
We're looking at most of the penguin species that are there, so a lot of our work will concentrate on the Gentoo, Adelie and chinstrap penguins. We'll also do work on flying seabirds, so skuas, giant petrels and sheathbills, which are the main scavenging birds down there. And then we also look at seals.
I'm interested in how you go about collecting samples from seals. They've got very sharp teeth. What do you do?
For those guys, we've been using a relatively non-invasive method, which is basically using a long pole and putting a swab on the end. And we basically sneak up on sleeping seals and then just wait until the nostril opens up to breathe, and then we just slowly insert the swab in like a COVID test and then pull the swab out and put that in our preservation buffer. So we'll do that with seals that are on land, so usually the Weddells and the elephant seals. And then for those that are on floating bits of ice, we just bring the Zodiac up against the ice and do the same process.
Quite quietly, I imagine. You wouldn't have the engine running. You'd just sort of sidle up. Don't wake that sleeping seal.
Yeah, we try and be as quiet as possible. Sometimes, unfortunately, you know, the Zodiac will nudge the edge of the ice, so they might wake up. But most of the time, they're pretty good. They're pretty relaxed and chilled. The only ones we don't use the method on are fur seals. They are quite angry and aggressive at times, and they're a lot harder to sneak up on. And they are ones that will charge and chase you. There have been some mass mortality events in crab eater seals happening down there, and with South Georgia, that has been heavily impacted by avian influenza. So the southern elephant seals and the fur seals have been hugely impacted. So this season when we went, we hardly saw any elephant seals, and the fur seal numbers were significantly down And there was a paper published at the end of last year that over the last few seasons, they've lost 54% of their breeding female elephant seals due to avian influenza. As it was just released a few weeks ago, the IUCN has changed the classification of elephant seals and fur seals, and the elephant seals is due to avian influenza. So an infectious disease has now changed the conservation status of a big, beautiful megafauna that we have. Yeah.
Do you have a particular species that every time you go down to Antarctica, you keep a particularly close eye out for?
The sheathbills, one of the probably big overlooked, they're not the prettiest birds. They're quite ugly little chicken-looking things. Aww. They also have very acidic poo, so a lot of the boats don't like them because they like to poo all over the zodiacs, and being quite acidic, they can cause damage.
Like strips paint?
Yes, they're very, very acidic.
Wow. So, that's a point.
Yeah, they're not the I guess, the most popular. Plus, their diet predominantly consists of other animals' poo. But they are a really, you know, important species. And, you know, we have been noticing at a lot of places this year, we weren't seeing the numbers of sheathbills that we normally do. So it's, again, probably one of those species that could easily quietly disappear without people noticing.
When you visit, how do you feel?
Yeah, it's very difficult because when we first started going there, you'd go and some of the beaches you couldn't land at because there was just way too many fur seals. And you have, you know, some of the colonies there is, you know, hundreds of thousands of penguins. And now you're going to beaches and, yeah, it's, you know, some are empty compared to what they were a few years ago because there's not the animals there anymore. But also we are, when we do some of the landings, there are lots of carcasses. And so it is quite devastating to see that change in such a short period of time. Mm. That's sort of the big thing. Normally, with population declines, you're seeing them slowly happening over time. But to see it within a couple of years is quite devastating.
Considering what you've seen and documented and analysed over the years, what are your hopes or fears for the region?
The big fear is the impact of avian influenza. You know, penguins, we have a pretty good idea of their population sizes. For our non-charismatic species, our beautiful scavengers, we don't have that data. The scavengers are important for cleaning up sites, getting rid of the sick, the weak, the diseased, in a sense. And so you lose them from the ecosystem that has flow-on effects that can then affect other species and how the ecosystem interacts. But then on top of that, other impacts like fisheries, climate change, pollutants and things like that. So it is quite concerning.
Avian influenza is spreading along the Antarctic Peninsula. Every time you go back, you're seeing more of it further afield. Does that increase the chances of an incursion into Australia?
Yeah, so probably one of the biggest risks that we had. So last season, we saw the virus go from South Georgia, which is just south of South America, move around about 5,000 to 6,000 kilometres eastward to some of the other sub-Antarctic, so Crozet, Kerguelen, Marion Island, which are off South Africa. And then sadly, as we know, this year, it moved even further east to Heard Island, which is one of our sub-Antarctic islands. And so the big concern now is the next movement is to Macquarie Island and the New Zealand sub-Antarctic islands, because a lot of the species that are being impacted, like the giant petrels, albatrosses are also getting quite heavily affected as well. They have that circumpolar migration and they move around, especially a lot of the juveniles. So they can easily fly those distances, very short periods of time, and moving that virus around, that if it then gets to Macquarie and the New Zealand sub-Antarctics, we then have other species that then migrate up to New Zealand and Australia, and then that is the threat. So historically, it was always thought that it would come via Asia. We have been very fortunate that it hasn't come via that route, but now we have got that risk of it coming from the south.
Dr. Megan Dewar of Federation University. Of course, the H5N1 strain of avian influenza doesn't just infect birds and seals, it can also infect humans.
And while there's been no person-to-person spread, avian influenza does have experts talking about pandemic potential. So if it did get to that point, how would vaccines be made? To find out, I spoke to Dr. Karen Laurie at CSL Seqirus, where she looks after a lot of different viruses.
Hundreds of viruses. If you think of a library, we think of books and on a shelf. And essentially, we've got viruses in little vials, in boxes, in freezers.
So does that make you the virus librarian?
Yeah, maybe.
Who uses all of these viruses?
Manufacturers use all these viruses to make vaccines. When we make flu vaccines, we need to have a starting virus that we use to put into manufacture. And so we call this virus a CVV, which stands for a candidate vaccine virus. And so this is a special virus that grows well in manufacturing, but also has the properties of the viruses that are circulating in the population. And we've got seasonal CVVs and also special CVVs, which would match non-seasonal viruses or viruses with pandemic potential as well.
How do you add to the library? Like, do you just go to the trams and wipe down the handles and see what comes out?
So there's a really great surveillance program that happens around the world. People probably would have seen a little bit of this in the COVID pandemic when they had swabs taken and then they were given to different laboratories who did testing on those swabs. So those swabs also then go to National Influenza Reference Centres and then on to WHO collaborating centres. And there they perform lots of analysis on the viruses to look and see if they're genetically and antigenically similar to what's in vaccines or if they're changing. And if they're changing, how to then update them. And then CVVs are created and the manufacturers use them.
So the swab that I got in March when I got flu A could well be feeding into a library like this one?
Definitely, it could be.
So to be clear though, there's no way that these viruses can get out?
No way at all.
So when has this library really shone?
There's actually two examples that I can think of. So one was in 2009 with the H1N1 pandemic, which occurred all around the world for influenza. So we have viruses ready and we were able to make new viruses very, very quickly. And then we were able to scale up our manufacturing and make influenza vaccine for this pandemic virus and have it released by TGA within 100 days of the pandemic being declared. Now, if we think in the current situation, there is also a H5N1 virus which is circulating around the world. And so this virus is called a clade 2.3.4.4b, which is a certain group of viruses. Australia is currently the only continent where this virus has not been detected. But we're still prepared. And so in our library, we've added versions of this virus and we've got them all ready to go in case we need to manufacture this quickly.
What would get you to pull the trigger on creating H5N1 vaccines?
So there's a few different triggers or signals we look for. Currently, we're seeing this virus go from birds into mammals. It's going from mammal to mammal, and there's very, very occasional infections from mammals and birds to humans. These are the early warning signs. The next level of signals we'd be looking for would be human-to-human transmission, and this would indicate it was getting very, very serious. For us to change our manufacturing, WHO would declare a pandemic, as they did for COVID in 2020, and so that would be a switch for us to change manufacturing from the seasonal campaign, where we make the seasonal vaccine, to this new pandemic vaccine.
Dr. Karen Laurie. Her official title isn't virus librarian, by the way. It's Director of Multipathogen Surveillance at CSL Seqirus in Melbourne. And this is The Science Show on ABC Radio National. We see the end result of pollination all the time. It's on our dinner plates, it's in our lunchboxes. But the act itself is one of nature's most mysterious collaborations. How do plants attract the perfect partner? And what hidden signals guide the pollen exchange that keeps our food growing? To explain, here's ABC Science top fiver, Dr. Chantelle Doyle.
So they're all about who's the best deliverer of pollen that they can find. So pollination is an exchange of sex for food.
I love that. That's going to be the title, Sex for Food. I'm Dr. Chantelle Doyle. My job is to conserve endangered plant species. And to do that, I need to learn how to help them make the best quality seed they can. Or to put it more bluntly, my job is to act as a plants-only matchmaking service. Many of us probably learnt that pollen lands on a flower and then a seed is made.
But have you ever wondered how? To help me explain, I have enlisted the help of some plant sex experts.
My name's Jeremy Fan. I'm the Director of Conservation at the Chicago Botanic Gardens.
Jeremy, in school, I think most people are aware that pollen lands on a flower and a seed is made. But that might be the end of our knowledge. So I'd love it if you could explain what happens after pollen lands on a flower.
I like to remind people that when we talk about the birds and the bees, we really are talking about plant pollination. So in a good system, the pollen will land on the stigma, which is the tip of the female part of the flower.
Let's just pause here. So, unlike humans, many, but not all plants, have both male and female parts on the one flower. I want you to picture a lily flower in your head, like the one you get from a florist that drops all the brown and yellow powder on the table. After the petals, you might notice those yellow or brown jiggly parts on stalks. They are the male part of the flower, called the anthers, which hold the pollen. Inside the pollen is sperm. Then we've got the female part, the stigma. The stigma is in the very center of your lily flower and usually looks like a spike.
The pollen lands there and the stigma can either be wet or dry. If it's wet, then it's great. The pollen can start germinating. If it's dry, the stigma or the female part needs to produce some liquid to allow the pollen to germinate. And that's one way plants decide if they like pollen or not, is they decide if they turn on or turn off.
So if this is starting to sound similar to reproduction that you might be more familiar with, you aren't alone. Way back in the 1680s, Nehemiah Grew published a book called The Anatomy of Flowers, comparing pollen to so many little testicles, which answer to the menses of the female. Anyway, back to the plant world.
Once the pollen has got the moisture it needs, it will germinate. And so the pollen starts growing a pollen tube down the style of the flower.
A little like an erection. The big difference is that sperm cells in plants can't swim in pollen.
They have to create the swimming tube themselves, and so that's where the pollen tube becomes very important for allowing that sperm to swim its way down to the ovule and eggs. It doesn't literally swim, but, you know, for visuals, it helps.
Unlike people, the sperm is not just needed to fertilize the egg and create an embryo. The sperm also helps to feed the seed as it grows.
Fertilisation is actually a double process.
This is Dr. Susan Hobie, a lecturer at La Trobe University.
So it's called double fertilisation, and there's actually two sperm cells. So one fertilises the egg cell, the other one has to fertilise some very fancy cells called the polar nuclear cells inside an ovule. And that's going to lead to production of something called endosperm, which is the nutritive tissue for a growing baby plant.
It sounds simple enough. We've got two sperm cells, one that fertilises and the other that contributes to the needs of the growing plant. But why then doesn't a plant just pollinate itself? Here's Jeremy again.
Some plants, the flowers don't even open, and the pollen of the same flower touches the female part and they produce seed, and some of our crops do that. Wheat does that, barley, some of the big crops, they don't even open their flower. Pollinating yourself is a good strategy if you need to produce offspring quickly. So if you're the first individual to arrive at a place, that could be a good way to colonize quickly.
Then naturally, you might ask, why do plants have flowers at all if they can just fertilise themselves and colonise quickly? Well, some plants can fertilise or clone themselves, like grass that uses runners or stolons. But there's a catch.
However, for the most part, as with most organisms, selfing too often just results in what we call inbreeding. And as we know, inbreeding generally increases your chance of mutations that are not good.
But sometimes selfing, or pollinating yourself, can be a good backup plan.
So violets are cool in that they do both. Suffice to say, they produce two flowers, one pretty, attracts pollinators, does the whole thing. And if that fails, they have a backup system where they produce a second flower, which is just made to pollinate itself to guarantee some offspring next year.
So to answer the question of why plants have flowers, one reason is to reduce inbreeding. Most plants at some stage do flower, even your lawn grass, and that is where things get really wacky. Because plants can't move to check out the dating scene and they don't actually have access to plants-only Tinder, they have had to get creative in how they have sex. And many plants have many different, let's say, positions.
So many of these different crazy ways that plants produce sexual organs is really always focused around preventing selfing from happening.
As well as mating with siblings or parents.
So they are plants that are dioecious. So these are the plants that have the separate male and female plants.
Just like humans, they have separate males and females. But in plants, this is fairly uncommon.
You can then have plants that have, on the same individual plant, they physically have female flowers and male flowers.
Which is called monoecious, or one house. But the flowers you are most familiar with, like daisies or the lily I asked you to imagine, they are usually hermaphrodites.
So they contain both male and female reproductive organs within the same flower itself. And then if we take our hermaphrodites, then we start going a little bit crazy all over the place. So we can go through something known as heterostylic. So that's different positions of male and female organs. The other one that I quite like, and it's related, is flexistyle. This is a really neat system where you can have a temporal change in the position of the style. So, for example, in the morning, the style might be at the top part of the flower bending down, and by the afternoon, it might flip.
They might flower at different times. So the male part of the flower is receptive at a different time to the female.
There's two types of individuals in the avocado group. There's the ones that produce the male in the morning and the female in the afternoon. There are other individuals that do the opposite.
And then comes a foolproof method in the dating world known as rejection. Or in the plant world, self-incompatibility.
Where the pollen or the pollen tube isn't allowed to grow if the plant recognises it as self or identical to itself. The female doesn't become moist enough for it to germinate if it sees the cell wall to be the same. And in some cases, a plant will digest the pollen tube if it looks like itself, and so it prevent its pollen from reaching the egg. There are many other complicated ways in which a plant will prevent selfing.
But the systems themselves are just unbelievable to think how these evolved and how clever it is that the plant can come up with these suite of arrangements.
Why do plants have so many variations?
To get healthy seed, you need to move pollen around between different plants. You want to increase the amount of genetic diversity. So you want to diversify everything. You want to have some of these different systems that minimize inbreeding. But you've got to think that plants aren't isolated in their environment or in their ecosystem. So all these different plants are all competing for sometimes different, sometimes the same pollinators. So they need to have different systems to make sure that either they get floral constancy, that means the same pollinator coming to them regularly, or that maybe pollen is deposited on different positions of a same animal that's bringing the pollen to the flower, but the different positions relate to different plants that they go and pollinate. So I think probably that underpins a lot of the reason for why we see all these diversity in how male and female reproductive organs are structured in a flower.
So because plants can't move, to make healthy seeds, they have had to develop a huge variety of ways to have sex or reproduce with the most genetically diverse partners that they can access. But for insurance, many plants still retain the capacity, as a last resort, to clone or even mate with themselves.
I do love pollination. I often tell people that if plants were to use an app, they would use something that's a delivery person. So they're all about who's the best deliverer of pollen that they can find. So pollination is all about an exchange of sex for food. They give them food and the plants get sex. But I do love pollination.
The systems themselves are just unbelievable to think how these evolved and how clever it is that the plant kingdom can come up with these suite of arrangements of their flowers.
That story from Dr. Chantel Doyle from the University of New South Wales and Royal Botanic Garden, Sydney.
Over on the West Coast, science producer Rose Kerr caught up with Professor Kingsley Dixon, a botanist who brilliantly found the ingredients in smoke from bushfires that's so vital for other plants, even crops. And he's just got another prize.
On a hot summer's day in Boorloo, Perth, I popped over to the Shenton Park Field Station to meet someone very exciting.
Kingsley Dixon, I'm a botanist and Professor of Botany and Restoration at the University of Western Australia.
Kingsley Dixon is a big name in the botany world. In fact, as a former botany student, I have one of his books sitting in my living room. He's most known for his research on orchids and carrakinolide, a chemical found in smoke that helps native plants germinate after fire. He was the Foundation Director of Science at King's Park and Botanic Garden, and even featured on David Attenborough's Private Life of Plants. Just recently, Professor Dixon was recognised as WA's Senior Australian of the Year for 2026. But long before all these achievements, he wasn't actually enrolled to study botany in the first place.
It was 1972. I was a first year student and had been enrolled to do agriculture by the high school that I went to, even though I'd said to the vocational officer, I want to do this thing called botany. She was wonderful, but she thought botany was done in agriculture. But then in my first day there, I saw the Department of Botany. I had to change my enrolment. And so my journey began there.
Kingsley has just started a new project, one that involves the building we're standing in.
This is our brand new home for conservation sciences and restoration component of UWA that in the last 5 months I'd been charged with building and championing that for the community and for First Nations. It's a building from the late 1960s. It's quite a wonderful building because it has this wonderful public works feel, who was designed by government architects.
Yeah.
But to me, it has a particular charm. But most importantly, we're embedded in 33 hectares of the best quality bushland out here at Shenton Park. We're less than 10 minutes from the CBD, but it gives us the square meters for us to live the vision of reimagining better botany that creates in the next generation real botanists. Mm. And I think I can actually see the opportunity to leave an enduring legacy, which I think is probably the happiest moment in my life.
He says one of the reasons why it's important to bring new ideas into botany is to tackle the immense challenges the environment is facing.
We hear the doom and the gloom that we're in the sixth major extinction. We're not in it. We're well through it in Australia. 11 mammals extinct, 70 plant species extinct. We think in the next couple of years we're going to see an exponential rise in the extinction curve, and that's because 48% of the entire continent in 250 years has essentially been smashed, mostly because people didn't understand two things. The bush is not inexhaustible, it's finite. And the second thing is that we're dealing with one of the most unique continents that almost has ever existed.
Yeah.
More unique plants and animals than any other place on Earth. And it means that we don't have the simple solution to save them, restore them, rebuild their population. And I guess the future of what I hope to produce here is that we in spirit find young Australian minds to go forward with vision, passion, the science, and the ambition to make the change that we need. It doesn't mean a change to business or the way people have incomes, but it will mean people will be able to enjoy the bush as I've enjoyed it and as generations before me have.
You're also someone who has an amazing garden and you're at your own place.
Oh, yes.
And unfortunately, I remember reading that there was a bushfire that went through. I wanted to ask about how the restoration after that was going.
It's 160 acres. Mm. 90% of it is almost pristine, but logged, wonderful, temperate eucalyptus forest. No fire since the famous Dwelling Up Fire of 1961. And it arrived on the 23rd of March.
That would be in 2024.
28 degrees, no wind. The embers just kept falling. We should have stayed and defended. We'd already been prepared for that. We had our equipment, but there was just two of us and we could find nobody to support us. And I lost my nerve and we went. We caught on camera when our various buildings and gardens caught on fire. It took almost 5 hours for the fire to do it. But the great news is the bush is just so remarkably resilient. It's uplifting. We've spent the last 20 months planting more plants than I thought was humanly possible to put in the ground. Wonderful support from the native plant industry. Extraordinary people have donated literally thousands of plants. In many respects, the fire provided me with a new gardening opportunity and a bigger, wider palette that I can get right. And so we're actually overjoyed with where it's going. Good. The bonus being that because the native garden got burned, well, I didn't appreciate everything had put seed away.
Oh, wow.
So we've got black kangaroo paws have come up, like that's the jewel in the crown. Everybody wants to grow that. Come up everywhere. I'm going, oh, my God, I'm there. Black kangaroo paws central. Waratahs have come up all through the garden. And so they're all prips staked. And we're going to have this amazing natural garden from natural regeneration that's occurred. So I don't recommend it, but there had been a lot more silver linings than downsides.
That's good. And your partner gets involved in the gardening as well.
So my husband, Lionel, we call him the Chancellor of the Exchequer. He's an accountant because as a botanist and a passionate gardener, things like numbers and bank balances seem to be an irrelevancy. But he has for 49 years been such a backstop through all of this. And together, him 81, myself 71, I guess in many respects it just teaches you no matter how old you are, we're Australian, we pick ourselves up, we move on, and we know how to dig deep within ourselves. I didn't know we had this resilience. And gosh, we fall into bed most weekends still. We go, oh, I'm so tired. But there's nothing more uplifting than to see honeyeaters back in force, our three wrens, the variegateds, the white wings and the splendid wren, all back in great numbers. Now, what we've done to recreate their habitat has mattered. And our first echidnas had turned up. Ah, oh, we're so overjoyed.
Wonderful.
So we're just feeling that nature and ourselves have partnered over the last 20 months and now we're on the journey out.
I love hearing stories about people who aren't formally trained botanists or environmental scientists really embracing being a hobby botanist and a gardener. And those people are so important because, like you said, they contribute so much to the environment.
That is so true. I call it the white coat syndrome. Mm-hmm. People somehow think you're a botanist, you're untouchable, you talk a funny Latin language mm-hmm. and all the rest of it. In our lab here, I've said to people, take the white lab coats off.
Mm.
When the community are here, we are with the community. Everyone can be a botanist. And in our little community of Waroona, just south of us, where we run our big garden, we've got 538 members in our local garden.
Wow.
A little town that nobody really knows about. And in amongst them are people that I hold in awe. Their knowledge, their gardening ability is outstanding.
You were recently awarded WA's Senior Australian of the Year. How'd you feel about it?
Predictably stunned. I suffered a serious dose of imposter syndrome, but the wonderful people of the Australia Day Council sit with you to train you that, in fact, it's an acknowledgement by your community that what you do is deeply respected and they want it acknowledged. And that has now come home to me. It means that all the stuff that I do, working with community groups, working with First Nations, working with the next generation of young minds, is legitimate. It's appreciated. And I guess that's really been extraordinarily powerful for me because I'm going, I don't mean I'm becoming an evangelist. Well, I am an evangelist for native plants. But because at times you think when you're not winning all the battles and we're losing species and we lose bushland and we lose forests, you feel I'm just not getting anywhere. And you feel alone. I now feel that the journey forward, I'm not alone.
Yeah.
And that is probably the greatest part of what that award means.
And it's even beyond, obviously, it being you, which is wonderful, to the fact that it is botany that is getting highlighted by that award is so wonderful to see.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And I think it shows
Australia is now ready to embrace a new way of working with the nature that we have. I think this is what I would call the transition point, or if we didn't, it's not a very nice future. If you are a native animal or a Banksia tree or a little orchid, it's not a very rosy picture. But I think the award reflects a real sea change in the minds of Australians. And we've seen it. It's post-COVID, this greater and deeper respect for nature and what nature can provide you with your own sense of well-being. There's nothing better than to see a beautiful piece of bushland in full bloom. You walk in it and for a moment you get cleansed, and it's a therapy when you've got real nature. So that's why the mission forward, I think, book is shared with many Australians through this award.
Broskow with Professor Kingsley Dixon from the University of Western Australia, a very good friend of mine, as is Professor Peter Bernhardt of Missouri, who is here at the Royal Botanic Garden in Sydney to launch his book Unsung Heroes of Pollination, subtitle More Than the Birds and the Bees, and it's published by CSIRO. Finally, there's been a changing of the guard of the Australian Academy of Science with a new president, Professor Sam Berkovic from the University of Melbourne. His area of expertise, epilepsy.
Epilepsy is a not uncommon condition. About 2% of us will get it at some stage in our lives. And it is due to a dysfunction of the normal regulation of the way brain cells work. Our brain is made up of billions of cells. They talk to each other in a very regulated way to allow us to carry on our actions, have our thoughts, have our memories. And an epileptic seizure represents a dysfunction of that, where the wiring basically misfires and you get discharges in the brain that are not normal. And the expression of the seizure depends on which part of the brain is affected by this. The causes of epilepsy are still being sorted out. We know you can get epilepsy after a head injury or after a stroke, but we also know that in most cases, the cause is not that apparent. The work we did helped reinforce the idea that much of it was genetic. And we were successful in pinning down some of the genetic causes of that. And importantly, particular genes that regulate the flow of ions in and out of brain cells were found to be very important. And that was sort of the fundamental discovery we made.
And does that mean that there are regular available treatments for most people?
Yes. Most people with epilepsy, thankfully, can be controlled by current therapies. But there are about a third that remain challenging to treat. And we're hoping that the genetic discoveries will lead to novel ways of dealing with this. And to some extent, that's happening. Not as fast as I'd hoped, but it is happening.
Yes. And what was the German discovery way back? There was one discovery of a particular gene, was there not?
Yeah, so the first gene that we discovered was done in collaboration with my group in Melbourne, another neurologist, Professor Ingrid Scheffer, who was my PhD student at the time, colleagues in Adelaide. And this is well before the Human Genome Project. Now we know where all the genes are in our chromosomes. At that time, we only knew relatively few genes, but one of them had been very well characterised by a German scientist, Professor Steinlein. And it turned out that this particular family we studied had a change in that particular gene. So we linked up with her and it all worked beautifully.
Wonderful. Now, way back in the dark ages, if you like, people who had these epileptic experiences were maligned in all sorts of terrible ways, weren't they?
Yeah, one of the problems as a doctor, and I'm a neurologist, I treat people with epilepsy, is the stigma with epilepsy, which is terrible. And it goes back a long way. Pretty well all the great religions advise people not to marry people with epilepsy, and that this is terrible. And that relates, in fact, to the genetic predisposition, when, in fact, many of the genetic causes of epilepsy are really pretty mild. So that should not apply. But you may be surprised to learn that as short as about 30 or 40 years ago, there were statutes in otherwise sensible countries that still said people with epilepsy shouldn't marry. It wasn't enforced, but it shows how these terrible prejudices go on. And certainly when I started this work, it was clear to me that genetics was a bit of a no-go area. It was hard to talk about it. We were discouraged from talking about it, and we did, and I think we've changed that perception, and it's led to some fundamental discoveries.
It's another example of the ways in which science, even though it might seem at first to be really basic science, following a line because it's interesting. I remember Howard Florey, we did a portrait of him, the man behind all sorts of amazing discoveries and the setting up of this very campus where we're sitting, the Australian National University. He said, if you think I'm doing this for the public good, no, I'm interested in the science. It's a wonderful challenge. That's why I'm doing it. And of course, he was to some extent tongue-in-cheek. But the good that the science does, and this is swerving towards your role as the president of the Academy of Science, how do you get your own champions, if you like, in this rather turbulent society where people are looking at all sorts of things, cost of the wars, the cost of the shopping, all those immediate things that distract you? How do you get a champion of science, as your predecessor, Professor Jagadish, has asked we should try to find?
Look, I absolutely agree. The rewards and the benefits of science to society come slowly. It's not immediate gratification. It takes a long time. Women in Australia no longer get cervical cancer, and that's due to work of Ian Fraser
in Queensland
with the Gardasil vaccine, which is now just commonly accepted, really important. And there are many areas in science where we benefit from that. And that begins with fundamental science where one doesn't necessarily see the application of it. And we need to support science at all levels. And unfortunately, at the moment, with the funding situation, young people are not attracted to science in the way they should be. And the ones that get in there have a success rate of their grants of about 10%, which shoos them away. And it's terrible. Public money has to be well spent. Grants should be hard to get. But if you've got a success rate of 8 to 10%, you are going to give up. And that's what, sadly, many young people do. And you just can't then reinvent a bunch of bright young scientists.
Well, you keep writing grant applications, the same boring papers, you know, page after page after page after page, and you get a straight no. It's so demoralising.
It is. It is demoralising. And again, we shouldn't make using the public money easy, but it's way too hard now. And we are losing bright young people from the scientific community, and they're our investment in the future.
What can the Academy do about that?
Well, the Academy wants to promote science. We've got the Advance Australia report now, where we hope investment in science will go from the 1.67% that it is now, at least to the OECD average, which is 2.7%. We need more money for funding. We need to strengthen our funding agencies, the ARC, the NHNMRC, the MRFF. The money should be made available for science so that we can see the advances and get the next Wi-Fi and the next Gardasil and these things that are pearls of Australian science.
Professor Sam Berkovic, President-elect of the Australian Academy of Science. Next week, discover how feeding wild animals shapes their evolution.
And why sex chromosomes are trouble. And that's according to a scientist who's dedicated her entire career to studying them.
The Science Show is produced by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.